As I was saying, Tom Iveser, an alcoholic, and I want to welcome you to the Sunrise Services. You ever notice that the closer you get to the work, the smaller the crowd? I don't know if that's an axiom or not, but that's just a matter of fact in our program. It is great to see you. I kind of like this way of doing, because this is getting down to nitty-gritty, and we're just here to talk a little shop this morning about doing our special work. And who we are this morning, at least the way I see it, we're a group of folks that are coming together on a beautiful Sunday morning in South San Francisco. And what brings us together is not just a common affliction, or not even just a common solution, but instead a common purpose. And that purpose is to work with the folk who are at the bottom of the ladder, in one way of speaking, whether it be in a hospital or in a correctional institution, folks that are at that critical point where it's either live or die. And we're folk who come together because of a special kind of interest and a special kind of zeal for that kind of work. And so I'm pleased to be in the company of folk who share that purpose. What I want to do this morning is go back to bed, really. No, not really. I've been awake since 5 o'clock, wishing I could go to sleep. It happens when you pass 40 somehow. You just sort of wake up earlier and earlier and more frequently. And I get exhausted trying to sleep from traveling back and forth. And what I really want to do this morning is just kind of relax and be together and just talk. And I'm about as casual as you can get. If you get much more casual than me, we'll all take a nap. And I would welcome any time that you want to comment or ask about anything whatsoever, feel free. And that would be a delight. I think another axiom is that we hear here all the time is the more you put in it, the more you get out of it. And it's amazing to me the meetings that I get involved in automatically take on an increased value. So feel free to jump right in and don't let me hog the whole deal. So informality and interruption is just fine. Somebody reminded me, several people have asked about Wallace Bryant, that many of you know, and he's the guy that I have the great privilege of sponsoring back in North Carolina. And I just got to tell you one Wallace Bryant story. Because I know that he came out here trying to look real slick and cool in California. And Wallace is an unusual guy. He's kind of an old woman in a lot of ways. He's just so proper and straight that, God, I've sponsored him and I feel like I'm sponsoring Jesus or somebody. He's just rigidly straight. And he's been that way ever since this thing clicked in for him. And years ago, when he was still, what does he call it? The mistreatment center. When he was in the mistreatment center in the penitentiary. Now, I don't want to gross y'all out, but do you know what chitlins are? Jeez. That's the most grisly thought I can think of. Well, he used to, some people lust after different things when they're locked up. And they'll bore you to death telling you what they're lusting after. He lusted after chitlins. And that sucker was always telling me about that he could eat a chitlin that reached across North Carolina. Well, one day I was in a store, and I said, I'm going to take that dude a chitlin. So I got one and put it in my briefcase. And I walked in and carried him to Chitlin. Never dawned on me. I didn't even think about it till later Everybody who's ever been in a correctional institution has observed a sign that says every person entering this facility is subject to search. I could just see the headlines of the local paper. Prison official captured smuggling chitlins. He never ate the thing. He was so straight that he wouldn't even get anybody to hustle up and cook it for him. So he still got the thing, I guess. I don't know. He never... Well, what a great guy, and I'm certainly going to remember to him all the folks that have asked me to. One other just kind of orientation that I'd like to do for my own comfort. I'm a mainstream member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not a special purpose member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. In every sense of the word, and although I have a special commitment to H&I, I have a resistance to being typecast as just an H&I performer. Because even though it's probably my strongest area of service, I'm not somebody who's interested in a disproportionate kind of service. I want to be a mainstream member. I was at a conference up in Detroit quite a while back. And the guy that was going to introduce me said, you wouldn't mind if I introduced you as a fellow who found AA up at Jackson, the penitentiary I was in. And I never had been asked that question, but I just instinctively said, well, as a matter of fact, I would mind. And he said, what do you mean? Ain't you going to tell that? And I said, God, I don't know. I haven't heard the talk yet. I don't know what I'm going to tell. But I would rather relate my experience from my heart and not from some billboard. Yeah, I don't want to get cast as a special purpose member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't want my past to define who I am. So I want to be a mainstream member. I want to be right in the middle of the boat. I want to be right in the center of the tent. I don't want to be in some tangential kind of activity. So that's basically where I come from. I've come to have a great appreciation for being very clear and definite about who I am and where I come from. It helps me a great deal to be clear and steady about that, because I don't know of anything more confusing that'll get you cross-eyed quicker than somebody who's bouncing all over the ballpark. That's particularly true for people who work in treatment fields or in institutional fields like I do, in trying to balance between my life in recovery and my professional life, and it can get awfully confusing. This morning, I'm willing to engage in any kind of conversation you'd like from the official standpoint, if it's useful. I want to just share one thing from that, a little bit from that perspective, and then talk primarily about the purpose you and I share from the standpoint of AA. So I want to do that and sort of get that out of the way from my point of view, unless you ask me to go back into it. Now, I'm a correctional administrator in North Carolina. That's my title, and that's my profession. And I'm just a regular correctional administrator. You know, one of the things I've had to work out over the years is, how do I find my proper place in that field? And when I first went to work in that, I was the first guy in history. And so when I was trying to find out how to relate, you know, how do you deal with a prison record when you're a prison official? Is it something that you're going to be talking freely about? Is it something you're going to be dealing with staff and training staff? Now, how do you deal with that? I didn't have anybody to ask because I was the only guy. And so I had to search out and find. And it didn't take me long. Inmates taught me very quickly how to deal with that, because I started very quickly encountering guys who would greet me as that loving soul brother AA friend. And I just loved that. And then all too often I'd hear, and by the way, and by the way. And so what I made up my mind years and years ago is that I'm going to be who I am. And as a correctional administrator, that's exactly who I am. I don't market my history. I don't market my status. I take my place in that profession like any other professional. I bothered, you know, I didn't just fall out of a maximum custody institution into a warden's chair. I'm sure you know that. Yeah, I did bother to work very hard. I did bother to finish my education in correctional administration. And so my history is incidental to how I carry out my professional work. And my recovery is personal to me. Now, I'm about as anonymous as the last earthquake you had out here in North Carolina. And so I don't hide my history. I don't market my history. And there's an important difference in that. So the one thing I want to just mention is from the standpoint of a corrections administrator, and it kind of goes a bit to what Dave was reading in the purpose. That's a demanding-sounding purpose, isn't it? It's a demanding-sounding purpose. I sometimes think that the most motivational thing you can say to a member of Alcoholics Anonymous is, you can't do it. I don't know of anything that'll pump up us more than somebody saying, you can't do it. And I swear to God, we'd climb over the wall to get in one of these places and they tell us we can't. And it looks that way sometimes from my perspective as a correctional administrator, because very often when you look at the balance of responsibility, when you look at how correctional administrators manage institutions in relation to us, it really looks like a disproportionate share of responsibility. That all too often when we're setting up a group, we do it on any terms. On any terms. And we tend to say, well, it's your institution, it's your rules, it's your regulations. Now, that's good to a point. It's also dangerous because it can go too far. Because we have principles, that's what rules and regulations are, and policies, they're principles of operation. We have principles that are just as critically important to us as a correctional institution. And when they're not observed, the chaos is absolutely predictable when they're not observed. And all too often, what we'll do is be overly cooperative and compromise the things that makes the program work. I'll give just one example of that. I've been sort of pressed into duty at a place out in the Midwest. Just because of my peculiar kind of background, I guess. And I've been pressed in duty by some buddies out there to mediate a range war between the local AA guys in correctional facilities work and a federal institution. And the range war basically has to do with the institution dictating policy relating to AA. And what they basically said is that there is no difference between AA and NA. They're the same program. So you mix the people. And it's operationally more sound for the administration. And I understand what they're talking about. You know, as an administrator, you have to be mindful of personnel costs. And if you run two groups, it's obvious if you have to supervise it, it's going to cost twice as much. I understand that. That's an issue in California. I know that. I've talked to administrators here and have had them tell me that they have to provide extra pay for people who are pressed into service to facilitate or whatever they do with AA groups here. So that's a very live issue. But let me tell you the product of that. How I got involved and I guess how they picked up on me as somebody to mediate or lead the charge. I'm not sure which they wanted me to do. I guess they knew I was a little biased because the administration didn't ask me to come out. It was the AA folk. I was invited to speak out there. And I'm a fairly easygoing guy. as long as it doesn't compromise something important. And when I got out there, somebody showed me the flyer for that meeting. And if you had tried to conceptualize the most gross violation of every principle in Alcoholics Anonymous, you could not have done better. It bore no resemblance whatsoever to anything that we're about. It listed me in big letters, Tom I, and then had a descriptive paragraph using full identification of my profession and my AA status on a bright flaming red poster advertising that it was the anniversary meeting of the AA/NA group at that institution. I've seen more sedate things on a circus deal. So my first, after I got through saying howdy, my first thing was, who did the poster? And he was a nice fellow. They introduced me to him, and he was a nice Buddhist fellow who was really into some Zen and things, and a nice guy, very brilliant fellow. And he and I went over against the wall, and we had a heart-to-heart talk. But at least I got out of my system what I had to get out. And then what we had, rather than a meeting, was just sort of a Noah's Ark. You know, it was a collection of two of everything you could imagine in that room. So there was no common, you know, like we have a common purpose here this morning. There was no purpose there. And that's what happens when we violate the principles that make us effective. That was done in the spirit of loving cooperation. But what was happening in the long run? What was happening? I would submit to you that the likelihood was greatest that we would wind up totally confusing people and driving them away from a solution, not attracting them in. So from the standpoint of a correctional administrator, and I won't talk the whole time about that, but when I look at something like that, let me state that purpose in a little bit more simple down-home language, because I think it says the same thing. I think there is an appropriate assignment of responsibility for both sides of the house that are clear and that do not involve collision. If I talk from the standpoint of a correctional administrator, and when I train staff, which I do a lot, I use this kind of simple homily to do so, that what is it that we want from a correctional administration when it comes to providing a place for an AA group to flourish? What is it we want? Do we want support? Do we want money? Do we want somebody to sit in and join us? Do we want partnership? Let me tell you, I think the only thing that we really want and the only thing that is legitimate for a correctional administration to do, and by the way, I would use this for any other program in a correctional facility, particularly those with a self-help orientation. And the task of a correctional administrator is not to initiate the process of change. The task of a correctional administrator is to provide an environment that supports and encourages change. Not to change. To provide an environment that encourages and supports change. What does that mean to an AA group? Certainly there's a responsibility to provide an environment that encourages support. What does it mean? Does it mean providing relatively easy access to the facility? You bet your life it does. You know, I suspect, and I was talking with Bob, I believe we were talking yesterday about the way some of it works here. And there's some really good stuff about the way that kind of thing is organized in California. There's also some very troubling stuff about the way it's organized in California. I'm meeting with one of the DOC officials down at the International. He's coming down, and we're going to meet just to talk about the procedures and policies for how you deal with folks who are kind of trying to come into institutions to carry the message. So there are legitimate issues. When you look at how we typically do it in correctional institutions, I think we drive away more people than you could possibly recruit by some of the ridiculous requirements that are in place. My own state is one of the biggest battles we fight is how to administer a reasonable access. So does it mean reasonable access? You bet it does. Does it mean an appropriate place to meet? Yeah, I think that's the responsibility of a correctional administrator to provide a place that supports the activity. Does it mean providing a place where relative privacy is in place? You bet it does. You bet it does. The nature of our work demands that. We may be able to do it in a crowded corridor, but I'll guarantee you that the product is going to be lousy at best. So it requires that, and a correctional administrator who's worth his salt will understand that providing a place that encourages and supports the activity is very legitimate stuff. There's also a critical place of when to say whoa. And there is a point beyond which correctional administrators sometimes get overly helpful. I've dealt many times with staff who just got caught up in it and they love to sit in on the meetings and even participate. And every time an administration gets too far beyond the line, it will be at the expense of the recovery program. There is a line where that has to stop. So it's legitimate. And when we deal with correctional folk, I think it's very important to put that on the table with what are the things that are essential for us to do. Now let's look at the other side. And this is just simplifying that purpose. There is a purpose for DOC folk. Now what's our purpose? Well, that purpose says it. You and I say it at every meeting. The only reason you and I go into a facility like that that's legitimate is to carry the message of this program. That is all. That is absolutely all. That's our only business, and it's the only one that we do very well. If we get to dabbling in trying to write policies, which I've seen some of us do, if we get into trying to influence parole decisions, which I've seen some of us do. If we get into the marriage counseling business, which I've seen many of us do. If we get into the romance business, which I've seen some of us do. I guarantee you it will be at the expense of whatever quality the program has. There's a line that you and I have to observe, and I think it's expressed, if not overexpressed, in the purpose. That if we stick to our business, we're the best in the world. But if we go over that line and start to try to influence the organization, it'll be at the expense of what we're about. So, you know, what the bottom line of all that to me is that the first meeting in any facility that we have, and it's laid out well in our workbook, the first meeting ought to be between the folks that are leading the recovery group development and the leaders of that institution. And it should be to negotiate the conditions under which we'll meet. Taking care of things about where we meet, what's the access, who's in charge, what do you do in emergency, negotiating all that stuff. And then I think, come to believe over the years, very vital to put that in writing. Because I guarantee you the next week nobody will remember what was said. And what that provides is a baseline of documentation so when something goes wrong, you don't have to start over. You simply have to go back and say, well, here's what we said we would do. And then either renegotiate or get back on course. We don't tend to do that. We tend to go in and we want to rush to the inmates or the patients and start doing our thing. And take all that stuff for granted. I would submit to you that that's a very important part of our carrying the message. A correctional institution is not a natural healing place. I've often said, particularly when I'm training management level people, that when we're putting a program like this in place, the sickest patient that we deal with is the institution itself. because it's by its very nature a place that breeds irresponsibility, breeds indecision, breeds doubt, breeds all kinds of stuff. So when you and I go in, part of what maximizes our effectiveness is that we go in with one thing in mind. And we stick to that, and people therefore learn to trust us. Anything anybody wants to say? Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. Al, I'm not sure that there is one as such. I'll tell you the way I approach it is I never take anything for granted, because when materials are written up, they're written in a universal kind of language. You know, they're written in general terms. If you look at Craigfield's workbook, it'll address these issues, but in very general terms, because it'll cover everything from a pre-release center to Quentin. And by necessity, yeah, I think you have to negotiate individually with those things. And so when I go to tell you how I do it when I'm negotiating with prison people, one mistake we make when we negotiate with prison people, and I've had people negotiate with me that didn't know I was in the program, and we tend to go at it at an emotional level. And we'll tend to just filibuster about anything. And use a lot of insider language. You know, we'll start talking to people about traditions, and they don't have any earthly idea what we're talking about. When I go to meet with prison people, I always know exactly what I'm after. I know exactly what I'm after. I've got it written down. And I never go over 6 points. It's not because they're that dumb that they can't handle more than six. It's just that six is a hellaciously good day's work. And most of the time I never have over six issues, but I limit it to that because prison people think in crisis terms. You know, they don't think in terms of reasoned long-term stuff. They think in crisis terms. So when I meet with prison people to negotiate, you know, I recognize that a program has to fit the environment that it's going into. And so what I want to do is negotiate the conditions that are critical to that. And so I go in, I never meet with them for more than an hour. I don't care if they got all day. I never meet with them for more than an hour. So I go in with a hit list of what's important to me, like, you know, supervision by staff. In some facilities, you must have supervision by staff, but it can be done unobtrusively. And it's one of the things that can most often be negotiated. The thing of, so that one is a fairly easy one to do. It's important for us to take the initiative because they don't know what we're doing. They just need to understand that we've got principles we operate by, and then they'll learn that they can trust us over time. But I go in with a hit list of what I want to get done. The first thing you mentioned, Al, about mandatory, that's about as gross a violation of what our program's about as you can get. And mandating folk into the program who don't drink or who just basically have a drug problem and demanding that they go to AA, that's exactly what I'm negotiating out in Missouri with those folk, because it had just totally ripped the program apart. You know, it totally loses its character and its meaning when you do that. And so that's something I would clearly want to put on the table. And I'll tell you frankly, and I've done it, when we go into negotiations like that, I have a point beyond which I won't go. And if we cannot have a suitable situation to do the program, we won't do the program. Because what it really comes down to me is that no program is better than a warped out of shape program. When I'm dealing with folks in an institution, I recognize one thing, that it's essentially, even though you got guys, many guys that are in there for years, I treat every meeting that I go into in a correctional institution like a newcomer's meeting. And what I've got in mind with that is that for many people, it will be the first real introduction they've ever had. And I want them to see Alcoholics Anonymous in its finest shape. I don't want them to see some makeshift kind of thing that's been designed for the convenience of an institution. That's not what we're about. And so I guess to distill it down, what I'm saying is number one, the first thing you mentioned, I wouldn't go for that. I wouldn't go for it. It can usually be negotiated if folks understand that what our purpose is. And the other thing I think can easily be negotiated about staff supervision. I've never seen that one as a major hang-up. And I've been involved in hundreds of negotiations of it. That is usually something that's highly workable. So bottom line, I'm saying three things. That every program has to be developed to fit the facility it's going into. Second, there are some things that are not negotiable, like who the program's for. And third, that those conditions can be done. But it has to be done one-on-one in every situation, I think. Anybody else? Yeah. Hey, John.
Good morning, Tom, and welcome to South San Francisco.
Thank you, John.
Very much. I'm
Thank
John.
You.
I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic.
Hi, John.
The question I have for you is a problem that I've noticed is what's the message? We have a preamble that says our primary purpose is to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety, and the fifth edition tells me that it's a spiritual experience, that I'm supposed to carry a message to have a spiritual awakening, to awaken the spirit, mm-hmm. so that we can remove the obsession of the mind, so that we don't drink anymore. It doesn't tell me, anybody can get sober. You slap the hell out of a policeman and you'll get sober. But as far as carrying, what is the message in your interpretation? Please tell us.
I think you just said it, that there is a solution that is spiritual in nature, and the message is that if I can make it through this God-given program, so can you. You know, I was sitting in a meeting one night, in a newcomers meeting. There was a young girl, not in a prison, this was my home group, and we were talking and having a little rap session back and forth. She said, can I ask a dumb question? I said, surely, go ahead. You're not the first. She said, I keep hearing about the spiritual side. And she said, what's the other side? Yeah. Strange thing. Yeah, the difference is, I think, that here we introduce folks to what a spiritual life is like. And folks can see in our, that's why I like the thing in the purpose about how we carry ourselves in a meeting. Because the way we carry ourselves is the message. It is the message. Let me shift over just for a few minutes, selfishly. I lost my speech. Yeah. I'm dangerous if I don't jot down some stuff because, God, I go all day. There were a couple of things. Let me just share a couple of things, and I don't mean to preach about this, but just some things that have sort of shaped in my mind that John reminded me of, about the things that I like to keep in mind, and I like to suggest to others to keep in mind going into a correctional institution. And the kind of principles or landmarks or something, I'm not sure what, but there are things that I hear folks get tangled up on a lot, and that I like to keep in mind in terms of clarity of purpose. One, I like to keep in mind that the alcoholic in a prison is no different than an alcoholic on the street, except for experience, and in many cases, not even that. I don't find, after 38 years of being around penitentiaries most every day of my life, I find a remarkable similarity between the guys and gals in the joints and the guys and gals out here. Not that much difference. You'll find some demographic stuff if you're interested in that, but the basic thing is that when I go into a penitentiary, I don't get caught up in some notion of difference. I see some people who go in who really think about folks in institutions kind of like folks from Mars, that they're a different breed of cat. When I go into an institution, I absolutely insist that I talk to alcoholics. I don't talk to convicts. This program is not Convicts Anonymous. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah, I was deeply grateful for every person who came into the institution I was in. The closest I came to not being grateful, at a minimum, I was grateful for the exertion, if nothing else. The closest I came to not being grateful was when somebody came in who demonstrated their attitude by the way they carried themselves, with the raunchiest, most vulgar, profane stuff that I could imagine. And what that said to me was that this is who you think I am. You see, the thing that was important to me, and I didn't like that. I never did like some muttonhead coming in polluting the only decency I had in my entire life. You know, prison week is made up of 168 hours just like everybody else's week. It just seems a lot longer. And 167 hours of my week at Jackson was characterized by the most barbaric kind of interaction that you could imagine between people. Barbaric. You know, an environment where kindness was seen as weakness. Love was a dirty word. Sincerity was like stupidity. And the entire week was caught up in predatory kinds of thinking and behavior. I've walked on that yard knowing that I would walk into a situation where I might live or die, but there's nowhere to go. And you either got to stand up and walk in or run. Well, that kind of environment characterized by man's inhumanity to man is not something I wanted to hear replayed in my A meeting. And what truly meant something to me were people who came into that institution and sincerely shared what they had, their experience, their lives, and not some kind of vaudeville act anyway. Talk to alcoholics, not to convicts. Very, very important principle for me. There's a thing that, and I picked up on some of it, that I think is awfully important in an institution. It's constancy and consistency. When you do an institutional work, I know that we were talking about Quentin and what a joy it is to go in, when you go in and feel like a guest. Now, it's not always that way. Yeah, because institutions do come in all shapes and sizes. You got some where you have to look at it as nothing more than 12-step call, where it will never be a well-organized group that has a solid structure. It'll always be kind of a 12-step call in nature in those high turnover places. But in places like Quentin and other places that I've seen, how important it is to be consistent and constant. Yeah, I know it gets tedious when you go in over and over. And if you're called on to share over and over and you think, Jesus, what else can I say? You know, I've said it all. But the one thing that you can't say too much is that you can count on me. Yeah, I believe that we come to understand a solution, and we come to trust by the lives that we are associated with. You know what I mean by that? That I think personally that it takes about 6 months for guys in a joint to even accept you as for real. You get a lot of tourists. You get a lot of people just want to go in and see what convicts look like. And then you get folks that have the commitment. And therein lies the trust. Yeah, I was sitting one night in a prison down in North Carolina, and it was Christmas Eve. And I was there. It wasn't even a regular meeting. I just sort of bunched some guys up and went over and visited. Paid Santa Claus, I guess. And there was one old lifer, and I'd sort of spotted him out of Claude. I kind of spotted him out of the corner of my eye.
And he was a cynical dude. And he was kind of eyeing me. And finally he spoke up and he said, "Can I ask you something?" I said, "Yeah, go ahead." He said, "What the hell are you doing here?" I said, "What do you mean? God knows you got to be somewhere. What do you mean, what am I doing here?" He said, "I mean, what are you, it's Christmas Eve, man. Ain't you got nowhere to go? Ain't you got no family? What are you, homeless?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I'm here because you're here." And you see the point? You see the point? Yeah, it takes a little extra dimension to cut through that wall of cynicism and distrust. And it's that kind of, you don't have to do anything spectacular. A prison is one of the few places I know where you can carry a powerful message and never say a word. All you got to do is walk in. Because most don't even look when they drive by. And guys in the joint know that. So that consistency and constancy, that it may seem repetitious and old, but I'll guarantee you it's the most powerful message of all. I know rotation is important, but so is that thing of trust. The other thing I like to keep in mind when I'm working with a prison group is to bear in mind it's the most critical group that I'll ever talk to. Now, you guys will be more critical than the average AA gathering. Now, I don't mean criticism like ADD awful. I don't mean that. But you guys are tuned into something special. We're down to cases here. And you'll be a little more critical than like last night. In a prison, it's far more. Because I think there's a sensitivity to things, real or imagined, where you don't really expect the best out of people. And the little things really become important. I went into a prison to talk to a bunch of guys a couple weeks ago. And it was a deal where I was going to do 2.5 hours on traditions. And when I walked in, they introduced me. I walked up to the front and they had a chair. And a sign on it said, "For Tom I's foot." They know me. I never thought about that, but apparently I have a mannerism among many that if I'm doing a kind of an engaged talk like that, tradition talk, I always drag a chair and put my foot in it. I never thought about that. But see, those guys noticed that. And they had set it up for that. They also notice how I carry myself. When I go into a prison, now I'm normally a fairly clean guy anyway. When I'm in an AA meeting, I respect what I'm doing. Because I never know who's here. I mean, my God, somebody might have brought their mother here this morning. And I know you didn't bring them to get exposed to some sewer mouth. I want to impress you with a lot of sidewalk language. Yeah, so I'm always pretty clean. You know where I'm the very cleanest? Is in a penitentiary. In a penitentiary. I dress a little better. I dress a little better. And I'm not trying to show off or try to look like I've got some glamorous lifestyle. I want to respect what I'm doing. I want to look like a recovered alcoholic. I don't want to look like a drunk. I want to look like a recovered alcoholic. Because when guys see that, you know, they kind of see something in it. They're a critical audience. They're as sensitive and as tuned in as any group you'll ever see. They'll listen more closely. Had a guy went into a meeting one time down in North Carolina that, what did we quit at 11? Is that what we quit at 11? No, I'm going to quit on time now. Diane, what time we quit? 11? Okay. Went in a meeting one night and there was a panel and there was a guy on there. And I knew he was salty, but I didn't know how salty. And after the meeting, Wallace, the guy that came here, Wallace came over to me and he said, "Hey, Chief, let me ask you something." I said, "What?" He said, "How can Billy stay sober?" And I said, "What are you talking about?" And he had started just casually noting every time the fellow said, "GD." And in the span of a 15-minute spot on a panel, it was 51 times. And I said, "Well, Wallace, he can't if he doesn't change." Within 3 months, Billy was drunk. See, I hadn't picked up on that. I knew it was a little salty, but I didn't pick up on that as nearly to the extent that Wallace had. So a very sensitive group to the fine things. I think you can relax and be yourself, but being yourself is the key of really being straight. First time I ever really understood how powerful the truth is in an institution was somebody asked me a question about getting released. Now, not as an AA, as an official. He asked me something about being released, and I said, well, I don't know, but I'll see if I can find out for you. Because he was a pretty torn-up guy. So I checked, and it was bad news. He wasn't going nowhere, no time soon. So I saw him on the yard the next time I saw him, and he said, have you found out anything? I said, yeah. And it's not good, and I told him the fact. That guy thanked me like it was a Christmas present. And he wasn't pleased at the news, obviously. But he was pleased at the truth, pleased to know. The most torturous thing is uncertainty and indecision. And that's characteristically the life of a guy in prison. It's that thing of just having somebody to just straight out tell the truth. A very important thing to be who I am. I tell you one other thing that I'll close up on this. Well, no, I was looking at the wrong clock. What time is it? Is it 10, 20? 25, 10. Okay, great. I won't have to rush this quite as much, but I'm going to knock off a little bit early so we can drink coffee and get ready for Beth, because that's my girl. That's my girl. When I look at what I've seen over the years in prison, it works. It really goes back to some of the stuff I've talked about here, that Alcoholics Anonymous in prison, to be effective, I don't think is 1 ounce different than it is on the street. Yeah, Alcoholics Anonymous, I've come to believe, is basically a process of, what'd I call it? I wrote it down. I can't read it. It's a process of experiential learning. That's kind of a flusy way of saying what you hear over and over and over in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's an experience in experiential learning. We say it another way in AA, is that you can't think your way into sober living. We live our way into sober thinking. That is such a critical thing to understand about AA in prison. I've never met, in all these years, I've never met a single guy in prison who has made it on the outside who wasn't making it on the inside. You know, this is a program of living, and it's not a program of circumstance. God knows how many guys and gals I've seen over the years who've gotten caught up in the throes of AA and have told me, always something sounds kind of like this. Man, this is good stuff. And I love this AA thing. And when I get out of here, boy, I'm going to set the woods on fire. At least 10,000 have told me that. I have never seen a single one with that party line do so. Yeah, there seems to be a truth to this thing that if I'm going to do it, the time is now. And the place is here. Experiential learning. That recovery comes from active involvement. It doesn't come from lofty messages. It doesn't come from technical knowledge. It comes from learning to live a new and different way. Yeah, this thing came alive for me. And I think this is so important, because when you think about it, if you think about the contrast in how the program works in the typical correctional facility and how it works in our community, in any community, you know, you think about your own experience when you first came in, where people encourage you to have strong relationships with a sponsor, to call them every day, that kind of thing. You think about the strong guidance you had to make plenty of meetings, make 90 meetings in 90 days at least. Hang around the club. You realize that every bit of that is totally meaningless to guys in a correction institution. It may sound like a nice idea, but it's a total unrealistic kind of thing. It isn't going to happen. Unless you've got a group that comes close to approximating the kinds of things that you and I do in the community. When I got involved, the recovery group where I was a member had about 300 members in it. And it really was an excellent group. An excellent group. Well organized, well run. We put a lot of care into inviting speakers. We had to invite our own speakers. We had to find our own speakers. Put a lot of care into that. A lot of stuff into the planning. A lot of stuff into the action of Alcoholics Anonymous. In that group, in 1958, I think it was, shortly after Narcotics Anonymous came into being, some folks wanted to start a Narcotics Anonymous group in Jackson Prison. Where would you turn for help? So the guys that had the drug problem said, hey, give us a hand. And we started in 1958 a meeting, a group of Narcotics Anonymous in Jackson Prison, and it's still there. Still there. Just a cooperative thing to help our cousins get started. Started a group in a mental institution inside the prison. Strange group. Strange group. Interesting meetings. My God, sometimes we had 25 going on at once. You know, some people had their own meetings going on by themselves. You know, strange deal. But what a tremendous experience in growth. Yeah, when you think about carrying the message into an institution, think about how vital it is to carry the message within the institution. Some of the best growth I ever had in my life was inside that penitentiary. Started a meeting in a TB ward that was in that strange, that was a stranger looking meeting. You're a bunch of guys in a prison with masks on. It was back when you had to wear masks in TB wards. See what I'm talking about? The experience of living, the experience of functioning in Alcoholics Anonymous is not something that's routinely available in institutions. Yeah. Hey, Bill.
Brisbane, and you had touched earlier on the principles of AA and like the integrity of the program and how it relates to other people coming in with other problems, like you said, NA and whatnot. And I just wanted to relate how I overcame. When I came into AA, I was kind of like floundering, and I was just looking for help, and I had a drug problem and an alcohol problem. And I didn't understand the difference between the two different programs. And you had spoken earlier about you specifically wanted to be in the middle of the boat and the middle of the tent, not being one way or the other. Mm-hmm. And in meetings at AA, I was finding the most voiced opinions were these people that were far to the right, and I felt were like, I didn't understand where they were coming from, or I didn't understand the principles. And they were, they seemed like a hate thing, or don't mm-hmm. talk about that, and I didn't understand it. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to relate how I finally came to understand what the principles were about and how it got to be, and why I come to AA to deal with my alcoholism. Is that a gentleman finally that I spoke to, because I would talk to these other people, and they would just be like, foaming at the mouth and red in the face. I didn't understand where they were coming from. And this gentleman, he just told me simply, he goes, what if, he goes, you know, like as a craftsman, I see the integrity of workmanship, how it loses its value, you know, as time goes on. Things lose their value and their strengths as they get passed from generation to generation if they're not kept true. And this guy said, what if a guy, an alcoholic, reaching out for help, came to an AA meeting and heard someone talking about shooting heroin? And just said, hey, what? I don't get it. Turned around, walked out, ended up dying an alcoholic. And when he tried to reach out. And that's, I just wanted to relate that. That's how mm-hmm. I finally came to understand mm-hmm. what the principles were yeah. about.
Yeah, thanks, Bill, very much. Yeah, the thing that we went through a kind of a combative period, and in fact, we're still in it to some extent. We went through a combative period in grappling with this thing when the proliferation of the drug culture came up and we started really encountering that. I mentioned that we had a little dinner last night, and I mentioned there one of my first impressions of Northern California was in the throes of that combat, so to speak, where AA, we in AA were sort of bashing folks trying to come in. at the first conference I came to in Northern California, I sat and listened to the most sensible, reasonable discussion I'd ever heard in the country. Right here in this place. I would have expected the wildest stuff here because I didn't know what California was like. And I heard a very sane and reasonable discussion. I'll tell you the way I look at this thing, and I'll just be real honest candid about this. You hear some of us, particularly us old mossbacks, that are yearning for the good old days. Well, I'm not one who yearns for the good old days. You know, I've had that dubious pleasure of having drunks throw up on my shirt. I've had the dubious, not even pleasure, of holding an alcoholic in my arms while he died and there was no place to go. I've had the thing of having to get called out at 3 a.m. time after time after time of hauling 3 drunks at once. I'm not one who yearns for the good old days. And even though it was great fun, it was a crude and makeshift way of trying to carry our message. It worked a little bit with heroic effort. Over the years, what we've seen is an industry grow up that's provided the critical care called treatment, the treatment world. And I know that it got out of whack, and there were some people who exploited the thing. You've always got that. But I'm one, even though I've never been through treatment, I'm one who values the fact that it exists and that there is a place where folks can get dignified treatment for a killer disease. What has concerned me so much is how we have dealt with that. You hear us old dinosaurs talking about, well, we don't get to do 12-step work like we used to. Thank God we don't. But what we do have is the greatest opportunity for 12-step work that our fellowship has ever known. What we deal with right now would put Jack Alexander's introduction of the onslaught to shame. In my meeting, man, I don't even have to go get them out of bars anymore. Folks haul them over in buses. My God, I don't even have to use gas to go get them. They just come in. And the key to me is that I don't think we as a fellowship have dealt with that very well. What we've done is rather than seeing a new face on 12-step work, a new opportunity on step work, what we've done is sort of backed off and started throwing rocks and talking about them and getting caught up in outside issues and starting to get aggravated and angry. And I understand that. It's just that it scares me mightily. See people come in who are caught up in that mindless circus where they have to get little slips of paper from some authority and come in and get one of us to sort of give it a little cavalier stroke of the pen. I don't sign them. And it's not because I don't care, it's because I do care. I take the chicken way out. I say, I don't do it, Beth will. Because I don't want to ever be anything to a drunk other than another drunk. I don't want to be the validator. I want to be another alcoholic. And so, you know, when I think about that and how we've dealt with it, what happens is that the drunk in the middle is the victim. We don't hurt treatment centers when we back off and get angry. We hurt the drunk that's caught up in it. We don't hurt the court when we refuse to deal appropriately with people who are drummed in. We hurt the drunk that's caught up in it. I tell you this, and I'll just close on this. I don't like to close on a heavy note, but we'll anyway, because this is the business stuff we're about. Some people worry about the future of our program. I'm one. I mean, my God, I've got concerns about the health of our fellowship and the solidity of it. For myriad reasons. Basically, I've got some faith, but I've got concerns. I'll tell you what the two heaviest are. And they're not outside issues. They're how we deal with a couple of things. Somebody told me one time, and I didn't know what they were talking about, but boy, do I ever now, that one of the greatest threats we would have would be for Alcoholics Anonymous to develop into being just another social agency. And what this guy was saying is that if we ever become just another little polite address on Main Street, where you bop in with about the same kind of psychology you do to Weight Watchers or whatever, we'll lose our utility. I don't need to explain to you why that's a troubling thing to me if you watch television, if you read newspapers, if you see what the common racket is in relation to Alcoholics Anonymous. Our sort of status symbol seeking that you see going on. That troubled me. And the other thing that troubles me when I think about it is that if our program ever dies, it won't be killed from outside. It's kind of like I was saying about institutions. You tell a drunk he can't get in, look out. He's going. What worries me is what happens on the inside. And it's the threat to our spiritual mission. We can't live with anger. We can't live with aggressive, negative thoughts to our fellows. And what I see that troubles me a bit is a thing I could only call hardening of the attitudes. Where we get polarized on those issues that they ain't like us. Lock them up, throw the key away. Don't mess with treatment centers. I'm not going to do anything with that court bunch coming in. That might be troublesome to folks who are being referred to us. My concern is that it's far more threatening to us than it is to them. Yeah.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Barry. I'm an alcoholic and drug addict.
Hey, Barry.
What you've said today has pretty put me in a lot of tears. It wasn't for H and I. They're the ones that carried the message to me in 1960 when I was sitting in prison. And then, I seen it again in the county jails and in the state hospitals. Through H and I a couple of years ago, I got involved in H and I again. I started going back into jails and back into mental institutions. And I liked it so well that I decided I wanted to get involved inside the institutions. Thursday night I just graduated with my certificate in the Alcohol Drug Studies program up at CSM. I had that honor. But at the same time, there was an even greater honor that was happening. It was that a 12-step meeting started inside that place. And it's something I've been working for. I work with people who are mentally ill, who have to be in compliance with medication. And they were out running around and they were drinking and using. They were self-medicating. And I seen this issue going on there as I started my internship. And it took me 6 months of talking to the staff there that you need someone from 12-step meetings to come inside here. That has happened now. You know, I know I still need to talk to Teresa. I talked to her on the phone not too long ago. And to see that happen and to see what's going on inside a place and to be able to offer it, I've seen some of the same issues brought up. I think Al brought the issue about staffing and stuff, sitting inside of meetings and stuff like that. That issue has already been brought up after the first meeting. And I've seen other things happen. But my thing is right now is the foot's in the door. And this is the starting.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be able to help people and do that.
Yeah.
I grew up with PTSD. I'm a battered and abused child. And a lot of things have happened to me through the years. You know, and I wanted to go back and I wanted to carry that message. And it wasn't just as H and I going inside and talking and sharing my experience. Now I'm in a spot like you. I cannot disclose. I cannot talk about what goes inside. What happened here and what experiences I've been through. And I knew that they needed that. And I came to the right people. I came to H&I. Because now the message is being carried and it's being carried cleanly. Yeah. Without real regards to that special population that's sitting there.
That's great. Thanks, man, very much. Folks, if it weren't for people just like you, I guarantee you I wouldn't be here. So I appreciate very much the fact that you care and that you're here this morning. I'm going to meet with the DOC guy that deals a lot with the program in California down to international. If you have any kind of a thing that you'd like addressed in that meeting, feel free, because, see, I'm from the other side of the country. Hell, I can say anything. You know? Thanks.